Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
This is The Writer's Voice, new fiction from The New Yorker. I'm Deborah Treisman, fiction editor at The New Yorker. On this episode of The Writer's Voice, we'll hear Joseph O'Neill read his story, Pardon Edward Snowden, from the December 12, 2016 issue of the magazine. O'Neill has published four novels, including Netherland, which won the Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction in 2009, and The Dog, which came out in 2014. Now here's Joseph O'Neill.
Pardon Edward Snowden. The poet Mark McCain received an email which had been sent to numerous American poets inviting him to sign a poetition requesting that President Barack H. Obama pardon Edward Snowden. The request took the form of a poem written by Merrill Jensen, whom Mark knew to be 28 years old, a full 9 years his junior. The poem petition rhymed Snowden with pardon, and pardon with Rose Garden, and Rose Garden with nation, and nation with Eden. It rhymed, or as Mark preferred to put it, it echoed, Putin and boot in, and Clinton and no disputing. Russia echoed USA, and USA Thoreau, and Thoreau hero. Mark forwarded the email to the poet E.W. West. He wrote, "Am I crazy to find this enraging?" Within seconds, Liz wrote back, "No." They arranged to have a coffee that afternoon. In preparation for the meeting, Mark tried to organize his thoughts. His first point, of course, was that the very idea of poem as petition was misconceived. A poem was first and last a Ding an sich. It definitely wasn't a message that boiled down to a single political humanitarian demand. It made no sense for an agreeing multitude or mob to undersign a poem. You could no more agree with a poem than with a tree, not even if you'd written it. Of course, the signers of the petition would argue that they were associating themselves with the text's petitionary substance and not with its formal properties, and that in any case poetry is a sword of lightning that consumes its scabbard. But accepting all that, Mark mentally counterclaimed, why not just have a petition in the form of a petition? Why drag the poem into the muck? Well, the undersigned might reply, a versified petition was likely to attract more attention and be more consequential than the alternative. To which Mark would answer, the good of poetry resides not in the... He began to feel a familiar dialectical dizziness. He set off to meet his friend, even though it meant that he would get there 20 minutes early. Liz was waiting for him when he arrived. They hugged. The moment they took their seats, Liz said, well, are you going to sign it? Mark said, I don't know. Are you? Liz said, not my problem. Nobody's asked me to. Mark paused. This was a complexity he ought to have foreseen. With extravagant bitterness, he said, "Oh, they'll rope you in." Liz mused, "I did a reading with Marilyn in January." Mark had attended the event, as Liz well knew. "I felt bad for him," he told her. "You really showed him up, without meaning to, of course." He went on. "Look, I do think this thing is chaotic. They're basically shooting out emails at random, and I don't think Merrill is a vengeful, petty guy. Far from it. I think his heart's in the right place, ish. But you know what? I could be wrong. He's obviously interested in a certain kind of success." Mark stopped there and was glad he had, even though he loathed Merrill Jensen. Whenever he badmouthed a colleague, however justifiably, he invariably regretted it. Strange, just what a draining effort of tact was required to get through the day without badmouthing another poet. In this instance, he felt, he hadn't thrown Merrill Jensen under the bus. He dissed him only in order to express solidarity with Liz, and only to that extent. Liz doubted that Merrill had overlooked her because she'd shown him up at their reading. In all probability, Merrill's recollection was that he'd shown her up. No, she had been overlooked because she was a woman. Whenever a stand needed to be taken and the attention of the public needed to be endured, the peacocks huffed and squawked to the fore en masse, idiotically iridescent. She decided to say, "We need people like Merrill. Somebody's got to be interested in being prominent, otherwise we'd all disappear." Mark said, "I expect Dylan has been contacted." Liz laughed. The singer's Nobel Prize in Literature had bothered her, yes. Literature was, in the first place, reading matter, after all, and Dylan's lyrics were mostly unreadable, and not even listenable to without the music. Even his supposedly best stuff would be torn apart if presented to the poetry practicum she taught every Tuesday, not only on account of its wordy, clichéd, hyperactive figuration, but more fundamentally because of the soothsaying persona that the singer so readily deployed, a trope that worked fine in a pop song, but on paper came off as a shtick. All that said, Liz had not taken the news as a personal hit. Mark, though, in common with many men of the pen she knew, had been knocked flat. For 2 days, he had not been able to leave his apartment or even to post on Facebook. Only after this period of grieving had he managed to discuss the matter with Liz at the same table where they now sat. At that meeting, Mark had reported that the night before he'd found himself thinking back to the 17-year-old who, wandering the public library of Forsyth, Missouri, inexplicably leafed through a tattered Norton anthology, and for the first time came truly face to face with a poem's mysterious verb visage. He still remembered the one that did it for him, Rothko's The Waking, funnily enough. "So take the lively air and lovely, learn by going where to go," he recited to Liz. And that was the moment he'd set off on a delightful, clueless journey in language, and for years he never once felt lonely or even singular, because at all times he felt this breeze, he said to Liz, on which the poems he would read and write might be accepted and held firmly aloft, and the air of the culture seemed filled with such breezes and such poems. "Yes," Liz said, "I know exactly what you mean." "Frank O'Hara did it for me," she said. "Which one?" Mark asked. She said, "Animals," to which Mark replied, "We didn't need speedometers. We could manage cocktails out of ice and water." And Liz wanted to hug her friend. "Anyhow," Mark continued, "the damn thing is, It's so hard to keep believing. And there's so much you need to believe in. Does that make sense to you?
It does, Liz said.
Mark said, you become aware that what you're doing is almost nothing. That it's just a few atoms away from nothing. And now, with this scandal, I feel that what we do is in fact nothing. I feel like it's officially nothing.
Liz saw that Mark had other things he planned to say, but was too emotional to speak.
Liz, they're calling him a poet, he finally got out. You know, they're not calling him a novelist. They're not calling him a songwriter. They're saying he's a poet, Liz.
I know, sweetie, Liz had said.
Seems like he's finally accepted the honour, she now stated.
Mark said, of course he accepted it. A guy with that much vanity, he was always going to accept it.
In fact, during the couple of weeks that Dylan had not responded to the news of his award, Mark had hoped that the singer would tell the Swedish buffoons where to stick it, that Bob had the integrity to recognise that an ultra-celebrated multi-millionaire who deals in concerts and extra-paginal iconicity is not playing the same game as a writer who sits down in a small college town and with no prospect of meaningful financial reward, tries to come up with a handful of words that will, unless something untoward should happen, be read by a maximum of 140 people and be properly appreciated by maybe 52 of these, of whom maybe 6 will be influenced. Make that 2. Once a year, a small beam of honour, reflected all the way from Stockholm, faintly brightened the dim endeavours of such writers. And now even this glimmer had been removed from their small and dark corner of the sky and tossed like a trinket into Bob Dylan's personal constellation. This sidereal imagery made Mark uneasy. Stars were almost always cheesy, doubly cheesy in the context of a pop star. But he had nothing else. Language was hard. And poetry, he'd always felt, was language at its hardest. He had recently expressed this point of view to his friend Jarvis, a writer of short-form fiction.
Jarvis said, really? Poetry's hard, sure. But good prose is just as hard, man.
Poets can generally do what prose writers do, Mark, a little drunk, declared. The reverse? Not so much. A day later, he received an email from Jarvis with a poem attached. Easy peasy. It seems that what's keeping what is as it is, the whole thing, is physics, whatever that is. Let's see. The fizz of the river, l'hiver, that Swiss watch thing. Liver. Every frisson, everything that's alive or that was once aliver. The leaf. The lever. He forwarded this to Liz. What do you think?
She wrote back, so great that you're writing again. This is good. Best thing you've done in a while. So effortless. Physics and fizz is a pleasure. And don't think I haven't noticed that the English language contractions erase I and you. In a poem drowning in materialism, that's just such a smart, playful way to raise the issue of subjectivity.
Mark didn't get back to Liz, or to Jarvis. Re the Dylan Nobel, Liz said, it's depressing. I can't separate it from the Trump phenomenon. The election was a week away. Yes, Mark said, and hypercapitalism too. The reader as consumer. It's an interesting question. He kept secret, even from Liz, the fact that he'd already written on this question.
It was a secret, because what he'd written wasn't a poem. For some months, Mark had worked surreptitiously and exclusively on a series of prose reflections that he termed pensées. How doable pensées were! The most difficult thing about making a poem, in Mark's judgment, was figuring out the text's relation to its own knowledge, figuring out, to quote from Liz's one anthologized work, the poem's claim to saying. There was no such problem with a pensée. You wrote as a know-all. Apparently, and here Nietzsche and Choran and above all Adorno were Mark's masters. The trick was to simply put to one side all epistemological difficulties and just steam ahead into the realm of assertion and opinion and emphasis. Boy, it felt good. With great gusto, Mark had knocked out, apropos of the hyper-capitalistic reader, "As class-based submissiveness justly evaporates, appropriate deference to expertise, rationality, and even data also disappears. This results from a state of affairs in which one's autonomy consists primarily in a freedom to consume. Objective realities are inspected like supermarket apples and accepted only if they tickle the fancy. If they don't, it's not sufficient merely to reject the apple. The apple tree itself must be cut down, and then the orchard. Hell hath no fury like a consumer inconvenienced. In this way, shopping is confused with resistance, a bogus egalitarianism prevails, a vicious man-on-the-streetism becomes dominant. The tricoteuses make their return, clicking not needles but touchpads. Need one add that the poem is the first to be dragged to the guillotine? Who knew that writing this stuff would be such fun? The voice, at once pedantic and forceful, and strangely aged and pampered, was the most fun of all. It was the voice of the irritable Central European professor, whose wife's principal domestic project is to ensure that her husband enjoys peace and quiet in his study. Mark had not had a wife, or a study, in 6 years. Liz and he became close during the chaos of his divorce, when he was outed as a cuckold and outed from his house. His male friends, he was a little shocked to learn, were ineffectual, indiscreet, and bizarrely merciless confidants. Liz listened to him sympathetically, and honestly too. When Mark said to her, "I was blindsided," Liz said, "Yeah, maybe." And he said, "What do you mean, maybe?" And Liz said, "Quarterbacks are blindsided. You weren't blindsided. You were myopic." Liz's criticism of Mark's poetry was similarly sensitive and forthright, and he was very grateful for it and happy to reciprocate. Her work wasn't right up his alley. It was a bit too academic and sexual. But there was no querying its intelligence and carefulness. In any case, Mark mistrusted his own alley, which at this point, as he'd remarked to Liz, was overrun by the rats of resentment. And the cats of confusion, Liz suggested, not to mention the dogs of disillusionment. If Mark envied Liz at all, it was for the growing kudos that E.W. West enjoyed as a writer who disturbed edifices of gender and sexuality. But it wasn't Liz's fault that her biologically and culturally determined homoerotic inclinations were now in vogue, just as it could hardly be held against her that she'd grown up in bourgeois luxury on the Upper West Side of New York City. Liz often complained to Mark about finding herself in Virginia, a dislocation that she experienced, as any reader of her Sappho in Sicily quickly grasped, as an exile. Nor did he hold it against Liz that in an unpublicized complication of her biographical profile, she was for the first time romantically involved with a man. His name was Pickett, apparently as a tribute to Wilson Pickett. Did anyone call their children after poets anymore? Mark doubted that there'd ever be a kid named McCain out there in the world. Or if there were, the kid would certainly be named for the political weasel John McCain. Mark had long felt defamed by this echo.
Every word is a prejudice, Nietzsche famously points out. One might add, every word prejudices.
Nowhere is this truer than in the nominal realm. One's name cannot be separated from one's good name. He cared deeply for Liz and was her biggest fan and cheerleader. He felt bad that she had not been contacted about the Snowden poetician.
So what should I do? He asked her. Sign it? Rewrite it?
Ah, Liz said. The patriarch's quandary. Mark did the work of smiling sympathetically. He saw that Liz was peeved and hurt, and with good cause. The problematic situation of women was not to be underestimated, not that Liz was in danger of committing this error. In her most recent sonnet, Mandate had been displaced by the neologism Womandate. Now Liz was, as she liked to say, lady pissed. Mark totally got it. But in the meantime, he had a problem of his own and an itch to explore the problem in writing. They had finished their coffees and their refills. It was time to go. The two friends stepped outside. It was a lovely November afternoon. They hugged and separately went off. As soon as he got back to his apartment, he wrote,
"We attribute to Bertrand Russell the following notion, that to acquire immunity from eloquence is of utmost importance for citizens of a democracy. We are curious about the notion because Stevens was, and we connect Russell's statement, thanks to Dennis Donoghue, to this one by Locke. I cannot but observe how little the preservation and improvement of truth and knowledge is the care and concern of mankind, since the arts of fallacy are endowed and preferred. If we grant Russell's words a merely provisional validity, we can ask, what is a verse petition if not fallacious eloquence? What is poetry if not a riposte to the forces of fallaciousness? What are these forces if not powers language?"
Mark wondered if he should explain that by fallacy, Locke meant deception. He decided not to. The reader would connect the dots. Not for the first time, Mark asked himself who this notional reader was. He had never, not once, met a disinterested party who had even heard of his poetry, never mind read any of it. Maybe his pensées would gain him a reader he could physically touch. He felt a wavelet of nausea. The feeling had a certain etymological justice. He had jumped from one ship to another. But what was the alternative? Write nothing? It had been months since he'd produced, or even wanted to produce, a word of poetry. Mark wrote, "How little I associate writing, properly undertaken, with the generation of the written. The more someone writes, the more suspicious I am of his credentials, as if this person had neglected his actual vocation in favour of the meretricious enterprise of putting words on the page." Then, "Sometimes I sit down to write and feel the internal presence of bad faith. Therefore, I desist from writing. On the other hand, what would it mean to write in good faith? That sounds even more suspect." He ate a cheese sandwich with mustard and olive oil. That was dinner. He went to his armchair. He wrote, "It is assumed that the writer's first allegiance is to language. This is false. The writer's first allegiance is to silence." Now it was dark out.
Usually the poet would read a book, but tonight he lacked the wherewithal. He opened a can of beer and went online. For a while he skipped from one site to another. Everything was either about the election or not about the election. He checked his email. Nothing new. Then he went on Facebook. Then back to skipping around the internet. He found himself reading, without interest but with close attention, about persimmon farmers in Florida. He rechecked his email. Hello. Merrill had written him again. Actually, Merrill had written Merrill. Mark had been BCC'd. The email brought exciting news. Funding had been secured from whom, Merrill didn't say, to buy half a page in the Times for the Poetician. This moves the needle, Merrill stated. Mark's reaction involved three thoughts. One, move the needle. Two, what an operator Merrill Jensen was. What a maestro of fallacy. Mark knew for a fact that Merrill not only disliked Bob Dylan's lyrics, but also disliked Bob Dylan's songs, which he'd once sneeringly characterised to Mark, who did like them, as pop's music. But sure enough, the minute the Nobel was announced, the prick was at the forefront of the congratulators and imprimatur givers, arguing that Bob Dylan was an unacknowledged legislator of the world, ergo Bob Dylan was a poet. It made Mark want to puke. The pseudo-reasoning, so right-wing in its dishonesty, and the big lie that Dylan somehow lacked acknowledgement. The big truth, not that anyone dared to mention it, was that Shelley's dictum needed to be revised. Poets were the unacknowledged poets of the world. Had Mark been among the scores of writers contacted by the media for their reaction to the prize, which he hadn't been, he would have spoken up for his comrades in verse. He would have faced down the wrathful online barbarians who vilified any perceived anti-Dylanite. Their favourite disparagement, tellingly, was the epithet nobody. He would have stated, "The status of poet is not to be worn like one of those fine ceremonial gowns sported by recipients of honorary degrees for a single sunny, glorious afternoon, not even by Bob Dylan. If there is such a thing as a poet's mantle, it is a $4.99 plastic poncho, useless for fashion, but good in the rain and the cold, and in an emergency." His third thought about Merrill's email was that his name had never appeared in the Times, and that if he signed the Poetician, it would. His apartment was on the third floor of a Victorian only minimally maintained by its owner. There was a bedroom and a kitchen living room equipped with an armchair, a desk lamp, a small sofa, and bookcases that entirely covered two walls. No television. There were two windows. When Mark wanted to pace about the apartment, his one option was to walk to and from these windows. This he now did. It was a journey that he'd made thousands of times, and thousands of times he had viewed the shingled rooftops of the houses across the street, and beyond them, in the town's small business district, two brown glassy towers. At night, you couldn't see much beyond the glare of the streetlight directly in front of the window, and yet evidently there was an inextinguishable need to approach an opening built into a wall for air and light, and to look through it. Somebody down there was walking a dog. That was a poem right there. The master, the leash, the joyful dog, etc. But the territory had been covered. There was that Nemirov poem, just for starters, and the one by Heather McHugh with that all-time great dog line, "Doctor of Crotches." A poem by Mark McCain would be water poured into a vessel that was already full, superfluous. He kept looking, which was another poem, a poem about the peculiar percipience of the one who gazes out a window. The poem would do for the window what theorists
had done for the threshold. It would offer the idea of the fenestral as a consort to the idea of the liminal. He wouldn't write it. The automatic metaphoric associativity of the window was just too much. He could always play with the associations, of course, but surely there had to be better things to do than play with the associations of the window. He returned to his chair and wrote, in less than half an hour, a poem that deviated from his previous work. The poem masqueraded as notes for a possible poem. It was titled Meditation on What It Means to Write. It read, Problem. A meditation on is a cliché. What it means to is a cliché. The very notion of a problem, colon, is a cliché. The very notion of is a cliché. Cliché strikes one as a cliché. As does strikes one and as does. Ditto inverted commas. Ditto, ditto. He did not write Merrill back. He did not put his name to the poetician. As soon as he had not done these things, he rose up from his chair. He went not to the window, but to the area between the chair and the sofa. He stood there with hands balled into shaking fists. Silently and exultantly, he roared, "Never give in! Never not resist!"
That was Joseph O'Neill reading his story, Pardon Edward Snowden. O'Neill's books include the nonfiction family history, Blood Dark Track. This is his second story in the magazine. You can hear more New Yorker fiction read by the authors on NewYorker.com and on the New Yorker apps, available from the App Store or from Google Play. On the New Yorker Fiction Podcast, we invite writers to choose stories from the magazine's archives to read and discuss. This month, David Means reads The Toughest Indian in the World by Sherman Alexie. You can subscribe to that and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. The weekly audio edition of The New Yorker is available on iTunes or Audible.com. Tell us what you thought of this podcast by rating and reviewing The Writer's Voice on iTunes. Our theme music is by Jordan Batiste and Ross Michaels of North American Plastics. The Writer's Voice is produced by Jill Duboff of NewYorker.com. I'm Deborah Treisman. Thanks for listening.